Hey guys, it's Albert. We're going to open things up by telling you what the four remaining quarterbacks can tell us about the state of the position in the NFL. Then Jenny and Beth in for Connor come in for the news. And as always, we wrap things up with a six-pack of your Twitter questions. Let's go. All right, welcome back. Divisional playoff weekends in the books. Conference title games on tap. It's the MMQB podcast with Albert Breer. And we're going to get to the coaching carousel. We're going to talk more about the conference title games. But I want to kick things off by getting into the quarterbacks and what they can tell us about where the NFL is right now. And I think it's so interesting because of the age gap. If you look at the four teams that are in the quarterbacks, we have four teams that are in the conference title games. We got a 41-year-old, we got a 40-year-old, we got a 24-year-old, and we got a 23-year-old. And when I looked at these guys, the biggest thing that stuck out to me was the entry point into the NFL for each of them, right? So you got the 23-year-old. That's Jared Goff. No, that's Patrick Mahomes. And he went 10th overall, and the Chiefs traded up to get him. You got Jared Goff. That's a 24-year-old. He went first overall. The Rams traded up to get him. On the other end of the spectrum, you got the 40-year-old. Happy birthday, Drew Brees. Turned 40 on Tuesday. He went in the second round. And then you get the 41-year-old, Tom Brady, and he went in the sixth round. And so what I did, I went and looked at all 32 teams. And what I found was 23 teams this year had a former first-round pick as their primary starting quarterback. That leaves nine outliers. Okay? Of those nine outliers, just three of those guys are under 30 years old. Those three, Jimmy Garoppolo was a second-round pick in 2014. Derek Carr was a second-round pick also in 2014. And Dak Prescott, who's the youngest of the group, was a fourth-round pick in 2016. And so what does that tell us? Well, that tells me that it is getting rarer and rarer that quarterbacks slip through the cracks. It is getting more and more essential for teams to find their next guy in the first round. Because these guys are coached a certain way in high school. They're evaluated a certain way in high school. They come out in college. They go to college, and there's a ton of exposure to each of these players. It feels to me like less guys slip through the cracks. And that's why, in the end, Dwayne Haskins, I think, is almost a sure thing to go in the first round. Kid from Ohio State. Daniel Jones, the Duke kid, I think, has a real good shot. And even Kyler Murray, who's like most NFL teams think. Now, I haven't put him on a scale or held a yardstick up to him or anything like that, but I know NFL teams think he's 5'9 and 170 pounds. And he could go in the first round. And so I think if we look at the conference title games and you look at the quarterbacks in those games and you look at the age difference and then you look at the entry point into the league, you're sort of seeing a different NFL where in 2000 and 2001, when Brady and Brees came into the league, there was a chance someone might slip through the cracks. You know, Brady slipped through the cracks because he was in a two-quarterback platoon part of his career at Michigan. Brees slipped through the cracks. Great player at Purdue. Slipped through the cracks because he was a little short. And I think you're seeing less and less of that now. And so I'm bringing Jenny and Bette, who's been sitting in for Connor Orr, who I think is traveling, right?
That's right. Mm-hmm.
He's traveling, yeah. Yep. And so I think this is so interesting because I think, you know, not only do there's so much you can learn about the NFL just looking at these four teams that are left, but I look at the quarterbacks and that age disparity, and this is true. Tom Brady was a freshman at Michigan when Patrick Mahomes was born. Drew Brees was a sophomore at Westlake High School in Texas when Jared Goff was born. Like, that's the age difference between these guys. And I think the NFL that Goff and Mahomes came into and the sport that they grew up with was a lot different than what you had Drew Brees and Tom Brady growing up with and coming into almost two decades ago.
So the question I have is, now, why do you think this is? Is it one, that it's harder for quarterbacks to slip through the cracks because there's just so much more video and people are more aware of things going on, whatever school guys are going to? Is it two, that the quarterback position has, you know, become even more elevated with, you know, the league becoming more of a passing league and these guys being trained from age, you know, eight and seven and seven leagues? Or is another factor that, you know, the NFL is not as good at developing guys who might not be blue chip prospects, right? Like, there's less practice time. Is there less of an opportunity to develop a sixth round guy who might have had potential?
I think these guys are throwing so much. I think that's such a huge part of it. And it's such a simple thing, but a lot of these kids are throwing the ball year round now. Like, and like Tom Brady was, I think, playing basketball and baseball a good part of the year, you know? Like Drew Brees was a great tennis player when he was growing up. And Patrick Mahomes also played baseball, but he was playing 7-on-7 in the offseason. I mean, Jared Goff, you know, again, son of a major, both those guys are sons of baseball players, but Jared Goff, like playing 7-on-7, then he goes to Cal and he plays in, you know, in an air raid system, and he's throwing, it's just the amount these guys are throwing the ball. I think eventually, it's harder for someone to slip through the cracks when there's that much exposure. When you're throwing the ball that much, when you're in front of coaches that much, like, I think it probably goes back, Jenny, I think it probably goes back to you're probably seeing colleges miss on high school kids less now because there's just, you're like, there's
huddle and these video film interfaces,
yeah.
Right?
I mean, I'm guessing on that, but I don't cover college football, but I'm guessing that that's probably a lot less of a crapshoot than it used to be.
Yeah.
It probably has to do with specialization with these kids at high school age. You have to pick a sport. Like, you cannot be a three-sport. It's so rare to see three-sport athletes in high school these days, because if you want to be a college quarterback and you want to be a top college quarterback, you have to be throwing the ball year-round. I mean, it's almost a detriment for you to be playing baseball, and coaches see that. It's like, oh, why are you playing baseball? Like, you're taking time away from getting better at football.
Right. Well, quarterbacks are like golfers, too. That's the other part of it now. I almost feel like there's, to some degree, it's almost become a different sport.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're trained differently. Like, they have personal coaches when they're really young, right? Like, when they get to high school, they're recruited differently than other players, right? Like, a lot of times you'll see, like, a kid commits as a junior. Now, all of a sudden, he's, like, helping the college recruit the rest of his class.
Mm-hmm.
And then they get to college, and it's like they're either starting or they're transferring. So their college experience is different. And then when they get to the pros, they're drafted differently. Like, the bar is a little lower. Like, you don't necessarily have to have a first-round grade. Like, if you're a guard, right, or you're a line, you need to be outstanding to go in the first round. At quarterback, you need to be really good, but they may be willing to overlook a couple things because of the importance of the position. So it's almost like they're coming up in a different sport. There's nothing. I can't think of anything like it in any other sport.
Mm-hmm. The quarterback is the most important position in football right now, and it's being drafted that way too. And I think that is showing in what you said and how these guys are not being missed and how teams are taking chances on them to get these guys early.
Okay, speaking of quarterbacks, our first news item for the week, and I think this one's fascinating. You may be sick of hearing about it because and buckle up, Bet, because we're going to be hearing a lot about it for the next month or so. Our first news item of the week. Heisman Trophy winner Kyler Murray declared for the 2019 NFL Draft on Monday, just 7 months after being drafted by and signing with the Oakland A's. And I love the way this kid's handling it. I just think that this kid is absolutely, positively nailing the business end of this. This is, I've got leverage. I'm going to use it. He's the son of a guy who was a pro athlete. His dad was a legend at Texas A&M. And it seems to me like this is a kid who understands how pro sports work before he becomes a pro athlete, right? Because if you think about it, he signs the almost $5 million. He signs the deal that almost has almost a $5 million signing bonus attached to it in June. So that becomes his baseline, right? But he can still change his mind. He can still pay that back. So at least he's got that in his pocket, right? Then he's got a full season to prove himself as a football player. So now, you're going out and you're playing on this big stage, and not only is he proving he can play, but he's making himself marketable, right? There's this big, it's almost like a Kyler Murray commercial for 3 or 4 months, right?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, the amount of interest in him right now is phenomenal. I mean, I came home yesterday. I was at the Adam Gase's press conference, but, you know, come into my building. The guy who works at the front desk in my building, shout out to Eugene. First thing he sees me and he asks about Kyler Murray, what do you think is going to happen? And, you know, so I agree with that side. It's that marketing. But he's, you know, this is going to be a really interesting discussion over the next few months about where he goes in the NFL draft.
So he's leveraged that, right? So he's leveraged that end of it.
Right.
So he takes that. So his football, now how well he played in football, now it's like he can go back to the A's and put pressure on the A's, because now the football thing isn't 7 months ago, that wasn't real. He couldn't use that. So he used what he had at that point, his baseball skill. Now he's using his football skill against his baseball skill to try to get more out of the baseball team and out of Major League Baseball, which seems for some reason to be willing to make a huge exception for him. And in the meantime, like, he can figure out, he can get a better gauge on where he's going to get drafted. So in football. And so to me, like, this is just like, I think it's like it's fascinating because it's like, it's a really cool story in that, like, we haven't had a whole lot of like the Bo Jackson, Deion Sanders types in this era at all.
It's been a long time.
And part of it's the specialization thing where a guy's so high profile in two sports. But I think it's also like there's an empowerment of the athlete thing here too, where the kid is actually treating this. And this is like, to me, it's like in the same category as Christian McCaffrey and Leonard Fournette skipping their bowl games a couple of years ago. They became the first to do it. Well, you know, I remember talking to Eric Winston, the union president, about this, and he said, this is great because these guys are actually making business decisions before the professionals. That's the same thing this kid's doing. Like, this is another, there aren't going to be very many kids who are in this position because it's a very unique thing. But I think it's great to see a kid who actually gets it and now understands, okay, like, I didn't have football to use against baseball, so I'm going to use my baseball to get my money. Then I'm going to play really well, and now I'm going to use my football against my baseball while I find out what my value in football is. And so
I guess my question is I'm looking 3 months down the road. If this guy gets drafted, say he gets drafted at the end of the first round, let's just hypothetically, does that mean he's giving up his baseball career completely? Like, if he gets drafted by a team in the first round, does he have to sign with that team?
There are a couple moving pieces there. So I think the first moving piece is to go in the first round. I think that you would, I feel like you would have to give those football, I think I feel like those football teams, like, would have to have assurances he's going to play football.
Okay.
Right? Like, so, like, I don't think any team in the NFL, I don't think any NFL team is going to blindly, because I think, I don't think it's a sure thing he goes in the first round, even if he does do that. So I think it's like I think it's a non-starter for NFL teams, like, the idea that he'd be a first round pick unless he, so to me, like, that becomes the real deadline, right? Like, it's before the draft. If you're all in on football, you have to let the teams know, like, I'm playing football, or else I don't think he goes in the first round, right?
So he wouldn't be drafted in, like, I guess I'm comparing him to Lamar Jackson right now. He's going to get drafted the last pick of the first round. Like, would not be a situation for him.
I think there's, like, there's some, so part of that is, like, having the fifth-year option, which is part of, like, that was why Baltimore, when the Ravens traded up, like, the Ravens didn't think, I think it was the Eagles they traded with, right? Like, the Ravens didn't think the Eagles were taking Lamar Jackson. Like, they didn't think that they were at risk of losing him there. They basically looked at it and said, well, if we trade up and get him with the 32nd pick, we have the fifth-year option. It's a business decision there. I still don't think – I just don't think a team's going to spend a first-round pick, like, on a guy who's already a risk because of the size thing. Like, I don't see a team spending a first-round pick on him unless they have assurances that he's going to play football. The second piece of this, I've heard that he likes football more. And I've heard specifically that he likes playing quarterback more. And so that's got to be a factor to some degree too.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, so it is an interesting question because he seems to be a borderline first round prospect anyway. Right. And, you know, maybe that sounds crazy given how well he played last year, but, you know, it's not just that he's,
well, you did the story on
smaller,
the size. Yeah.
Yeah, the smaller quarterbacks. Right. I mean, we saw, you know, to your point though, it's like, you know, Drew Brees, Russell Wilson, Baker, they're all kind of spaced out over years. And I think mindsets are changing. I think a guy like Baker does sort of prove is a more of a proof of concept that, the smaller quarterbacks is fine, building on the past success of Brees and Wilson. But I do think teams have to consider a lot of factors when making what would be an exception. And Murray is smaller than any of those guys and may be smaller. You know, you hear a lot about, are they strong in the, you know, their legs? Do they have powerful, you know?
Very careful saying
very
that.
Very careful phrasing here. And I think that, you know, you see Mayfield and Baker have a, you know, very, very powerful lower body. And I think Murray is a little bit smaller than those guys. So I do think that that's a consideration. And then, like you said, Albert, adding the baseball thing, so they would have to know. There's
the way it's, I mean, I think the most concise way of putting it is Baker and Russell are short, not small, right? Mm-hmm. I think Kyler is short and small. And that's a problem too, because, I mean, part of it is, if he's going to keep playing the way that he played at Oklahoma, which was they rolled him out a lot, they moved him around a lot, he ran a lot. Like, there's also the piece of this that's if he's playing that way in the NFL and he's not big, if he's not thick, like, can he take the pounding? You know, because that's, I mean, like, if you you have to reinvent yourself, and now can and it becomes a catch 22 because then it's like, well, at that height, can you really operate consistently from the pocket? Because he didn't do it at college, like that wasn't what he was asked to do at college. So there's like a lot of moving pieces there where he's a fascinating prospect. He's explosive as hell, like one of the most explosive players you'll ever see playing that position, and has a lot of juice in his arm too. And he's there's a lot to like there. It's just the size thing's real, like the size thing. That's not BS.
Where do you think he would fit best? On what team?
That's a good question. I think he would have to go like Arizona. I mean, I know Cliff said it and it got that attention. I think he would have to go to a team that is willing to think outside the box a little bit when how to use him. And there are more and more of those teams now. I mean, look, part of the reason the Ravens promoted Greg Roman to offensive coordinator was because they felt like he was more adept at building the sort of offense that it's going to take to make Lamar Jackson effective because he did it in San Francisco. And so, you know, I think that piece of it, I mean, if I'm looking at the teams that Miami would be a team that would be on my radar just because they're going to be looking for a quarterback, but we don't know who the OC is going to be there. I look at who was on Flores' list, like Roman and Kingsbury were on his list, and that tells me that Flores is going to be looking for someone who's sort of that way. But I don't know. You know, I don't know where that's going. Tampa was another one that, like, before Bruce said he's all in on Jameis, but, I mean, there is no way. If you look at all of BA's quarterbacks, they're all these big strapping guys because he needs them to sit in the pocket and take punishment. So it's an interesting question, and I'm sure we're going to be talking about it a lot.
Yeah, I mean, I think most teams would rather have a 6'2 quarterback. That's the reality. Yeah. But Baker, you know, he was exceptional in every other area, so the height wasn't a deterrent, right? And so I think with Murray, you're making an even bigger exception for size. And so are you, you know,
he needs to be that much.
He needs to be that much more exceptional. That's how I would look at it.
Okay. All right. Bet, Jenny, who wants to take news item number two? Who's got their phone up?
Go for it, Bet.
I got it.
Slow on the draw.
I got it. The 2019 head coaching hiring cycle is now complete. And six of those eight hires came on the offensive side of the ball. And the only two exceptions are Denver's hire of Vic Fangio and Miami's expected hire of Brian Flores. Is that so that, I think, is just exemplary of where we are. You know, everyone wants a new hot offensive coordinator.
Yeah. And I think you can tie some of it like so. You look at, like, there are a couple teams out there that had young quarterbacks that were looking for head coaches. The Jets, what do they do? They draft Sam Darnold last year. What do? They hire a quarterbacks guy in Adam Gase. The Browns, they have Baker Mayfield. What do? They literally took his guy who's his position coach when he came into the league 8 months ago and make him their head coach. And so I think a lot of it's about developing the position. Here's the other thing that I think it is. I think there are a fair amount of owners, and owners are involved in these, even though, you know, a lot of times we always see in the press release, right? Like, the GM is leading the search. The owner is absolutely a piece of this. I also think that there's this element of the entertainment value of the league this year, right? Like, which I think was much better than it was in 2017. Like, I think that it's harder to draw a rating than it used to be. It's harder to draw fans to the stadium than it used to be. I think that there are a fair amount of owners who would sit back and watch Rams Chiefs at the end of November and say, give me that. Like, that's what I want. And so I think that that's a piece of it too.
Yeah. And, you know, I think this is a tired point that everyone makes a lot, but I do think there's some truth to it, that if you have a defensive coach, there's always the question of who will the OC be? What will the identity on offense be? And then if that offense does well, the OC will quickly get a job somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think this year in the playoffs, you know, we see the four highest scoring offenses are the last four teams remaining. And so I just think there's just this emphasis, you know, on the offensive side of the ball right now. And I think, you know, the hiring trends will probably look like this for the next few years.
And I think that, like, part of the problem with it too, to me the issue is, and we're going to get into this more in the next news topic, but to me the issue, part of the issue is, if everyone is sort of pulling from the same pool, there's going to be overreaching. And so, like, I think that's why you get Cliff Kingsbury getting a shot. That's why you get Zach Taylor getting a shot. I mean, Zach Taylor, who might be great for the Bengals, right? Might be great for the Bengals, was the quality control coach in Los Angeles a year ago. You know, you look at Cliff Kingsbury, 35-40 in Arizona. And so that, like, it becomes like, okay, so now we're all looking in the same place. So now within that same place, we have to look where other people aren't looking. So now you've sort of you're going two steps now where normally you'd want to just go one. And so let's just jump into news topic number three. Jenny, you got this one?
I got it.
Okay. Because these flow right into each other.
They do, right. Yeah. We're sort of already talking about Rams coach Sean McVay saw his staff rated for the second straight season. Last year he saw OC Matt LaFleur and quarterbacks coach Greg Olsen. Or he lost them, excuse me. This year is the expectation is quarterbacks coach Zach Taylor will take the Bengals head coaching job.
And I think we have to, like, I think the key here is, like, if you're looking for the next McVay, I don't think you just look at McVay. I think you look at how the Rams found McVay, and that no one, like, there was not like this like feeding frenzy to hire Sean McVay, right? And so to me, like, that tells me you should be looking in other places, right? Because they hired a 30-year-old who they hired a 30-year-old who was the offensive coordinator of a team that didn't make the playoffs. And they were one of two teams that interviewed him. And once those teams got him in the room, all of a sudden it was like they both really liked him, and the Rams moved to hire him. But, like, I think that can teach you something too, that maybe you should be looking where other people aren't, you know? And I mean, maybe that's what Denver's doing in hiring Vic Fangio and thinking, like, there's no one looking for the old defensive coach, you know what I mean? Like, so we're going to hire a really good, you know, a guy who's got a ton of experience and coaches on the other side of the ball and is networked in the NFL and understands who is a good coach, who's not a good coach. We can put together a staff, all of that. But this, I don't know. There's, like, that whole thing where it's like there's going to be, like, to me, it's like if everybody's looking in the same place, you're going to wind up finding a lot of mistakes.
This might be a negative thought, but it's almost interesting to see who is going to bust. Like, you're like Zach Taylor and Cliff Kingsbury, they're like, I feel like both of them are not going to succeed at the level that Sean McVay is. And so, like, what I mean, it's kind of a negative point to have here, but it's like one of them is, you know, someone's got to break somewhere along the line here. So
You know, speaking of looking in other places, it remains baffling to me that running backs coaches don't get more consideration. You know, obviously Bieniemy was a running backs coach before he was promoted to OC in Kansas City, and he did get some interviews, but it's not getting a chance. But, you know, Anthony Lynn was a running backs coach for a long time, and that was a big impediment to him getting a job. And, you know, when he was in Buffalo, I sat in one week when they prepare the running backs, and if you actually sit down and see all of the things that the running backs have to know in a game, of course it's not just the run game, it's also the pass game, particularly now, you know, pass protections and with running backs being used in the passing game more. And so I think you really realize that knowing offense and knowing what's good for the quarterback doesn't necessarily have to come from someone who is a quarterback's and even receivers coaches.
I think it's offensive line coaches too, because
who has to
manage more people than the offensive line coach,
right? Munchak didn't get a job but interviewed, right?
So here's a good example, right? Like, everybody thinks of Andy Reid as a quarterbacks guy, right? Well, let's actually look at his background. All right, it's his first year coaching at BYU in 82 as a graduate assistant, 83 to 85 offensive line coach at San Francisco State, 86 offensive line coach at Northern Arizona, 87 to 88 offensive line coach at UTEP, 89 to 91 offensive line coach at Missouri, 92 to 94 offensive assistant in Green Bay, 95 to 96 assistant offensive line and tight ends coach in Green Bay, and then just his last 2 years as an assistant coach in Green Bay, he was the quarterback's coach. And I'm sure he did that. I'm sure he did that because he's like, that's the only way I'm going to get to become a coordinator, right? Like,
right.
It has to be. Like, so, mm-hmm. like, you look at Andy Reid, like, his experience, like, no, his experience really wasn't, like, now he's become a quarterback's guy, but, like, if you look at his background, like, it tells you, like, he was an offensive line coach.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you're right. Like, I think that there's, it's, again, it's just, like, if everyone's looking in the same exact place, then you're, like, necessarily narrowing what you're looking for. You're looking at the same group of people. And I just, it's, I don't know. I mean, I look at Pete Carroll defensive background. I look at Bill Belichick defensive background. John Harbaugh special teams background. Like, it's just, it's gone. It's absolutely gone too far. And that's yes. why we're going to see overreaching.
Yes. Connor Orr made a really, being doing my best Connor Orr impression today. Connor made a good point on in one of our newsletters this week, in one of the Morning Huddle newsletters, that you know, it's here we are. We've got the last four coaches standing. We have Sean McVay up against Sean Payton, Andy Reid, and Bill Belichick. And if Sean McVay gets blown out next or this weekend, like, is that going to change our opinion of all these coaches, or is that going to change our opinion offensive revolution?
I think if McVay had lost, if the Rams had lost in the divisional round, I could see that. I think at this point, if they lose on the road in the end, like, I have a hard time knocking him for that. You know what I mean? Like, 2 years ago, they were terrible. And, right. like, so, like, I could understand if he went 2 years in a row without winning a playoff game, then I'd understand some of it. I just have trouble, like, really tearing apart, like, the idea that he's a really great, really, really great young coach mm-hmm. because he couldn't go into the Superdome and beat Sean Payton and Drew Brees.
I agree. I mean, he's transformed that team. To your earlier point about Andy Reid with his background, I mean, one of the stories when I did a piece earlier this year on how their offense was evolved that really stuck with me, when he was the offensive line coach at Northern Arizona, yeah. this was a lesson that he has carried with him the rest of his career. Their quarterback was struggling. They had a freshman quarterback. He was struggling with the blitz look that the opponents were giving him, so they moved to a spread offense, reasoning that if people had to cover five guys darting all over the field, that he wouldn't face as much heat. And so I just think, you know, these lessons that you learn from wherever, whatever part of the offense yep. you're on, they contribute to your overall philosophy.
And that's a good jumping off point to news topic number four. I'm sorry, I went really heavy on the coaches this week. news topic number four, Andy Reid's back in the conference title game for the sixth time and the first time as Chiefs coach. He's one of three coaches with over a decade of head coaching experience to make it this year. The other two, of course, are Sean Payton, who has been – now, I think if you add it up, Andy Reid's in his 20th year. I believe this is Belichick's – if you add it all up, I think this is his 24th year as a head coach, if you add the Browns experience there. And then Sean Payton is in his 13th year, 12th if you don't count 2011. His 12th year as the head coach of the Saints. So – like, I think what's the one thing that you can tie together, and this is what I respect so much about Andy, and I know we talked about this earlier, and you went into the big story on it, how Andy Reid has been willing to reinvent himself. And I think you see it with Sean Payton. I talked to Sean Payton earlier in the year about how he steals plays from different offenses, you know, makes a point of watching Josh McDaniels coach and watching Sean McVay coach and watching other guys coach so he can take ideas. I think Belichick's the exact same way. I think that's what's so, like, so cool about, like, some the older guys is that, like, these older guys, like, and you can see examples of, like, how they've reinvented themselves, like Taysom Hill. Like, that is just, that's like an idea that seems to come out of nowhere. Like, no one's using a backup quarterback that way, right? Like, you look at the way the Patriots have used Cordarrelle Patterson. They've used him as basically a running back, and mm-hmm. this wasn't just like as a slash weapon. They were using him as an actual running back earlier in the year. And then Andy Reid with all of the different stuff that they've done on offense. It's just like, I think so much of this is like what's really cool about this round of the playoffs and seeing these coaches advance is that you've got the older coaches who have been so willing to reinvent themselves, and that's why they've lasted, is that they've it could be like a lesson for any of us. Like, they continue to reinvent themselves. They're not stuck in their ways, and they're coaching in a different way than maybe they were 10 or 20 years ago.
Yeah, like, you know, you talked to Payton about watching the other guys like McVay and stealing. I talked to Reid about it, and it's interesting that the four teams that are still in it are the four that, like, when Reid was talking about the teams that he'll watch, you know, it's McDaniel's offense, it's Payton's offense, it's McVay's offense, and of course they watch Reid, and you can see examples all over the film of plays that went from one place to the other. You know, the Patriots used a play that the Chiefs used against them the previous year, and then a version of that showed up on the Saints film. It was actually the touchdown that Breeze broke the record on. And it's so interesting to see that tracing, but it just is a reminder that even these most tenured offensive minds are stealing and sharing and open to new ideas. And I think it's a really important point that that is the reason they're the four highest scoring offenses. And
there's a humility in it.
There's a great humility in it. And also to let, you know, the other thing that Brad Childress, who worked with Reed, had mentioned was that, you know, when they coached on previous staffs like Holmgren and Green Bay, sometimes the younger coaches would bring an idea and he would say, okay, when you're a coach, you know, you can implement that, but I don't know it. It's not mine. And Andy is not like that. Like, he'll let any of his assistants, no matter how low they are on the totem pole, bring him a play and he'll say, okay, maybe we can run that. So I think that is a great humility.
Yeah. I just think that it's, like, if you look at like what, like, and I think the Patriots don't advertise it, but you see it constantly with them, right? Like, they almost change who they are. I remember talking to another head coach about this during camp, and we were, you know, I won't name him here because we were just shooting the you know what, but like, I, you know, we had he kept saying, like, he was like, if you look at what New England does, they reinvent themselves every 2 to 3 years, and they're constantly like, you're chasing what they're doing, and then they change, and so all that work that you did to chase them is worthless, you know? Mm-hmm. And it just sort of tells you, like, how football is absolutely this huge cat and mouse game. And now we'll talk about something non-coach centric, right? Like, so, Jenny, Bet, you guys want to take news topic number 5?
This is a juicy one. Steelers owner Art Rooney told the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette on Thursday that it would be difficult to envision Antonio Brown back on the team in 2019. Brown has 3 years and $39 million left on his contract with the Steelers.
Yeah, so. And you've been around Art Rooney, Jenny. Like, he is not bombastic. He is. I can, and this was to Jerry Dulac, been covering the Steelers forever. Like, you can almost, like, I can picture him saying it, which is probably in a very hushed tone, you know. And this tells me he's gone.
He also said last week that the team will not release Brown, but all other options are on the table. So it's clear that he's he's thinking next step here he's already putting into works that, you know, Brown is up for grabs.
Would you guys trade for him?
Yes.
I would put up my best offer. I mean, what do you have to lose?
I'd be hesitant. I think you have to have, like, I think you'd have to have really strong infrastructure. Really, like you'd have to have, like, I think there's a limited number of teams this would be good for. Like, and I look at, it's so, because I saw this, and I don't know if you guys saw people tweeting about it earlier, but like what Andrew Whitworth did, I think it was on the punt, right? Like on Saturday.
Mm-hmm, I saw your tweet.
Yeah, and if you watch the play, like Andrew Whitworth, who weighs 310 pounds, the Rams left tackle, is the first one down the field on the punt. And it was such a great example of, like, when the guys who are like the highest paid, best players on your team are doing that, there's pressure on everybody else to be that way. And I think having that and having Aaron Donald be the type of player and person he is, and, you know, Todd Gurley's that way too. Like, if you have that sort of, like, player infrastructure, then you can start to take risks. And that's why they were able to take risks on Aqib. And that's why they were able to take risks on Marcus Peters and take a risk on Ndamukong Suh. The Patriots have always been able to take risks because they have Brady and because Brady is the one who sets the, and there's just, you're not going to crack that. You're not going to be the best player there. And so, like, if you mess up, there, you know, there are people that's going to be self-policed, you know? And so I think, like, Antonio Brown, and it's crazy to be talking about a 30-year-old this way, but it almost feels to me like he has to go to a place like that where there's already strong infrastructure in place and he's not the number one guy. Like, it has, like, and I'm not saying number one receiver, but like number one guy in the locker room,
right?
You know, like, he has to go to a place where someone else is setting the tone. So if he does F up, then that'll be self-policed and it won't become a bigger problem.
Yeah. I mean, when I said yes, I agree. It's yes with a caveat. I think it would have to be the right team. You know, there's a consideration of, you know, do you need a top elite receiver to win a championship? And the history really has been mixed. I mean, you don't really need that. It's not essential. But I do think there's other problems in Pittsburgh it's not all Antonio Brown related.
Not.
So it's not like he's like the sole.
But that's why they have to trade him.
Right. That is because why they have to. Exactly. Right. And so that's why I think teams will be willing to make a move for him, because I think they see there's other issues, right? I mean, Bell sitting out the year and, you know, and Roethlisberger. I mean, you know, I think there's a lot of, and this evidently stemmed from a conflict with Roethlisberger. And I think there's a lot of questions about that, too. So I believe he could thrive somewhere else.
I mean, you are who your best players are. Mm-hmm. That's the thing. And so if your best player is acting that way, then that becomes a big part of who you are. And that's like, you can tell people what to do until you're blue in the face. But if you're letting him get away with that and there's no one policing it, well, then, you know, how, like what sort of tone is that going to set for everybody else? It's, again, it's like, and the fact that, like, if Ben were a different guy, like, they might be able to absorb it. The fact that Ben isn't a different guy is like, that's also like that compounds the problem.
Right? Yeah, I agree with that. Absolutely.
I mean, the guy freaking left work, like just went MIA for 4 days during the last week of the season. It's just like, and no one it took the head coach had to police that. Like, there was, like, it's just, and I don't know how you can even think about putting him back in that locker room now, you know?
Right, and I think that is why Rooney spoke up, which is uncharacteristic, as you mentioned. It's sort of reminiscent of times that, like, John Mara will speak up about Odell, and you're kind of like, you don't usually expect that from an owner like that. But the downside to speaking up by letting everyone know outright publicly that he's for sale is that drive the price down a little bit. Whereas if you were like, oh, we're trying to work it out, maybe teams would offer more, thinking that they have to give up more to pry him from the team.
Well, and he's... Mm-hmm. The one thing they have going for him there is the contract. Like, cause, and that's why I put that in there, Bet, is like, yeah, the 39 over 3 is actually, for a high-end receiver, that's really affordable. Like, mm-hmm, that's what's left. Now, his contract initially was worth a lot more than that, but because a lot of the upfront money's gone now, you're getting him over the next 3 years, presuming that he's not going to come in and ask for more, which is absolutely a possibility. Like, he could say, I'm not accepting a trade anywhere unless you pay me again. Mm-hmm. But if he's willing to go on those terms, like, $13 million is less than Mike Evans is making, it's less than Odell Beckham's making, it's less than Sammy Watkins is making, it's less than Allen Robinson's making. It's a very, very affordable number for a guy who, again, is, like, inarguably one of the three or four best receivers in football.
And Jerry Rice went on radio earlier this week and said that Antonio Brown wants to play for the 49ers.
Jimmy G.
Yeah. You know, I don't know.
I think on the field he's like what they need.
But that would go against
that's like
thing.
See, I just don't know. Like that's the thing, is like, would he go in there, would he be such a dominant force in that locker room? Mm-hmm. Like they might be off the table. Like, I don't know. Like, your quarterback is still sort of getting his footing as the leader there.
Totally.
Like, he would go in and be the
Richard
the top
Sherman.
Guy there,
Richard
I
Sherman.
Think.
Richard Sherman is like Richard Sherman for all of his, like for all the noise around Richard Sherman. No one questions his work ethic. Mm-hmm. Like, no one questions how engaged he's been on the teams he's playing for. Like, there's, like, he's not a problem from a team standpoint, you know. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I don't know. San Francisco's the one that, like, on paper makes some sense to me. You can never rule out the Redskins, because it seems like trading for him would be such a Redskins thing to do. Mm-hmm. So, but there are a limited number of teams that I think could do it. And then the question becomes, like, how far are the Steelers going to go to make sure that he doesn't come back and bite them? Like, is it just out of the division, or do they want him out of the conference altogether? Like, there's that question too. Like, if I'm them, I'm not, like, if the Patriots call, I'm going to hang right up. if I'm the Steelers, right?
Right.
You wouldn't even think of it. So there's that question of about it too. All right. Let's pick the games. We haven't talked a ton about the actual matchups. Let's start with the early game. It's the NFC game. The Rams going into New Orleans. Jenny, who you got?
I'm going to go with the Saints. I mean, I know they won the first meeting between the teams. Mm-hmm. You know, it's hard to beat a team twice in a year. But and they got off to a sluggish start last weekend, certainly. But, you know, I just think the experience factor carries them here. I don't know.
Bet.
I got the Saints. I think it's the home factor, too. And the fact that, you know, like you just said, the Saints already beat them once this year. It's hard to beat a team twice, but I think that the Saints are kind of in their head a little bit, have that mental edge there. So I got the Saints.
And that's going to make it a clean sweep, because I don't think the Rams are quite as complete as the Saints. Like, what was so impressive about what the Saints did against the Eagles, the defense won that game. Like, it was and they've had talent. Like they've built like a good base of talent there. And losing Sheldon Rankins, I don't think is something you can ignore. But like with your Marshawn Lattimore, your Marcus Williams, your Marcus Davenport, you trade for him, Alex Anzalone, like all the talent that they brought in there, like they're actually probably one of the five or six most talented defenses in the NFL, and they can win a game on defense, and I don't know that the Rams can. So I got the Saints too. AFC, Jenny, who you got?
Full disclosure, my preseason Super Bowl pick was Saints versus Patriots, and now that we are pretty close to achieving that,
now
my playoff pick that we did in the beginning of January was, I veered from that a little bit, but I'm just going to stick with my August pick. So I'm just going to say Patriots here, you know, because that's what I believed then, and I'm going to stick with it. Listen, that was a different Patriots team last week that I think a lot of us expected, and they looked like, as they often do, their best when it matters the most.
My preseason pick was also Saints-Patriots, and my January pick was Saints-Patriots, so I'm going to go with Saints-Patriots as well, and I was feeling a little nervous about making the Saints-Patriots pick at the beginning of January, 2 weeks or whatever ago, but I feel much more confident in that pick after watching them last week.
And I, you know, like there's still like a lot of this that tells me I should pick the Chiefs, but last week I picked the Patriots because I thought something funny would happen, right? Like, I was like, the Chargers are, I like the Chargers coaching staff, and I think they've got the best, they've got better talent on both sides of the ball, and everything's telling me to pick the Chargers, but I just can't do it. Like, and I remember saying, like, I think something weird's going to happen and the Patriots are going to win, right? Like, I think nothing weird happened.
Nothing weird happened.
Nothing weird happened. The Patriots came in there and crushed them.
Just doing the normal stuff.
Right. Yeah. And I go back to December. And I look at, like, how close the Chiefs and Chargers were. And, like, how – I don't know. I mean, it's just, like, I have such a – like, I know Arrowhead's a factor. I love the way Patrick Mahomes has played. I think he brings a totally different challenge to the table than Phillip Rivers brought last week. I can't pick against the Patriots in this spot. I just can't do it. And, I almost feel like the Chiefs coaching staff against the Patriots coaching staff, what if it's close late? Like, who do you trust more?
Right. I mean, you give the edge to the Patriots. I mean, I also think it's, you know, notable that Brady posted a video of him working out to 50 Cent's Many Men. Mm-hmm. It's really representative of the mentality that he'll be carrying this weekend.
Yeah. Yeah. What was it like? He said to Tracy, like, everybody thinks we suck, right?
Yeah.
Like,
I mean, that was
pretty forward.
That was forward. Yeah. And then Devin McCourty said something similar. And it was so funny because, like, I was in the locker room and I hadn't really seen the Tracy Wolfson interview until midway through my locker room. But, like, every other player was asked that question and they all kind of brushed it off. But then you have your offensive leader and your defensive leader being like, yeah, everyone thinks we suck. I mean, playing the underdog card for the Patriots headed to their AFC title game is quite bold.
So it reminds me of this is the year before I started covering the NFL, right? In 2004. All right, the Patriots had won 2 of 3 Super Bowls, okay? They had lost to Pittsburgh. They got killed by Pittsburgh earlier that year, right? It was Roethlisberger's rookie year. And so the Patriots were 14-2. The Steelers were 15-1. The Patriots went into that game a favorite. Like, how common is it that a team goes and is a road favorite in a conference championship game? And a road favorite in a conference championship game playing against a team that crushed them earlier in the year, right? Mm-hmm. And Rodney Harrison said after the game, no one believed in us. Rodney, everyone believed in you.
Literally
everyone.
That's great. That is great. Oh, man.
So, all right. Appreciate you guys coming out. All right. We'll jump right into the six-pack. You guys know how this works. Every week on Tuesday, I put the call out on Twitter for questions. You guys ask. I pick six. If I pick yours, you get a like on Twitter. That means I hit that little heart and you get an answer here. We'll start with question number one. Guys, a regular Andrew Fisher at Colts Fisher. Any insight to the Colts releasing their offensive line coach? Andrew, I don't think that this is much more complicated than Frank Reich wanting his own guy in there. There were three coaches that were under contract when Frank Reich got that job earlier in 2018. These guys were guys that Josh McDaniels had handpicked. Matt Eberflus, the defensive coordinator, Matt Fair, the defensive line coach, or Mike Fair, the defensive line coach, and Dave DeGuglielmo, the offensive line coach. Those are the three guys that were under contract when Josh backed out, when Frank Reich became the head coach. There were other guys, Jonathan Gannon's one of them, that were also Josh McDaniels guys that wound up there. I think the move here on the defensive side of the ball, I think Frank's fine with what's gone on. Ultimately, the offensive line coach is one of the most important coaches on the staff, especially for the guy who's running the offense. And the guy who's running the offense, Nick Sirianni, is a big part of that, but the guy who's running the offense is Frank Reich. And so I think being very particular in what he's looking for in his offensive line coach, that makes sense. And so I think this is about Frank Reich getting his own guy. Question number two from Michael McGowan at Med Writer Mike. Does the NFL's current rule about not hiring coaches who are still in the playoffs hurt their chances of getting the staff they want, or do they talk to people off the record? Michael, a lot of times there are intermediaries involved that will help these coaches in these situations. There are two of them this year that are still playing after having, I mean, not accepted jobs, but maybe come to a little wink, wink, nod, nod agreement. That's Zach Taylor, the Rams quarterbacks coach, who's going to be the head coach of the Cincinnati Bengals, and Brian Flores, the linebackers coach in New England, who's going to be the Dolphins head coach. In both these cases, I think you get some experienced guys in there. And even if they're not under a contract yet, maybe have them start to work the phones. Jim Caldwell is a name that I've heard could be involved with that in Miami with Brian Flores. A couple names to watch, and we'll talk about more about this in a second. Daryl Bevel and Mike Sherman, potentially, Zach Taylor's father-in-law in Cincinnati. And so there are ways to do it. It's competitive for assistant coaches. It's not ideal to build a staff when you're still in the playoffs or have to build a staff when you're still in the playoffs. Obviously, you can't be involved in interviewing guys, bringing guys in, that sort of thing. But there is a way to at least build the foundation of a staff, and then you have to try to make up for it later by being maybe more creative when you're hiring. Question number three, this is from Paul Grega, at Paul Grega. That last question flows right into this one, the coordinator predictions for Cincinnati. I would predict that Daryl Bevel will be the offensive coordinator there. I think having an experienced offensive coordinator makes some sense. If they are going to go younger, I would keep an eye on Brian Callahan, the quarterback's coach in Oakland. On defense, I wouldn't be surprised to see it be someone like Jack Del Rio. Again, an experienced hand to sort of offset Zach Taylor's lack of experience. And look, I mean, Zach Taylor's had a front row seat for all of that, right? Had a front row seat for all of it in Los Angeles, seeing the way a younger coach has to operate. And of course, Sean McVay showed great humility. I'll use that word again, humility, in bringing in Wade Phillips, a guy who's been a head coach three times in the NFL. And I think hiring Jack Del Rio as defensive coordinator or someone like that would certainly mirror what McVay did in Los Angeles. Question number four is from a Jets fan. His handle is at NotSince69. Joe Namath references. His name's Will. What is the situation with the Jets and Greg Williams as DC? If not him, who? Need a strong presence since Gase admitted DC will likely be head coach of the defense. Well, I think part of the problem here for the Jets is that they had three names and two of them are off the table. And so Greg Williams has a lot of leverage right now. He's had interest from different teams. Maybe by the time you listen to this, he's been hired. But the three names that were in the mix that were on Adam Gase's list, Vance Joseph, who's now the defensive coordinator in Arizona, Chuck Pagano, who's now the defensive coordinator in Chicago, and then Greg Williams, who, again, I think has considerable amount of leverage in his contract negotiations with the Jets. Question number five, this is Chris from Plainville, at Chris Plainville. How much of Andy Reid's coaching style is predictable? See last week Chargers. Can Belichick be confident that Reid won't stray too far from the script? # game planning for the Chiefs. Chris, I would tell you that Andy Reid has done a good job of tweaking things and his route combinations and the way he runs his offense on a week-to-week basis. And I can tell you for a fact that that gave the Colts fits last week. There were little tweaks in how they used Tyreek Hill. There were little tweaks in the route combinations. There were just little tweaks that threw the Colts off just enough that it caused huge problems for them early in that game. And so I would expect the same thing this week, that you're going to see Andy Reid tweaking his offense, not changing it, tweaking his offense a little bit to throw the Patriots off. It's worked to a pretty high level over the course of this year in Patrick Mahomes' first year as starter. And finally, question number six. This is from Matt Anderson at Maths Anderson. Does Antonio Brown's diva attitude impact his value to other teams? Will the offers the Steelers get be of lower value than they expect? I don't know if they're going to get a one for him. He's 30 years old. There's all of the extracurricular stuff, of course. I think this sort of depends on how many teams are in on him, and I think there are a limited number of teams that could absorb him. First of all, if you're not a win-now team, you're probably not going to want him. And if you don't have strong leadership or you've had any sort of locker room issue, you're not going to want him. So that narrows the field of teams that would be bidding on him. Now, to offset that, again, like I talked about with Bet and Jenny, there's the contract, which is affordable, $39 million over 3 years. There's no guaranteed money left in that, so you get out of it when you need to get out of it. If he's willing to come to San Francisco, to Washington, wherever it is, on that contract, then that's a really good price. And so there are two pieces to that that I think, on one side, yes. On one side, the fact that the scope of teams that would be looking at him might be a little more narrow than you'd expect for a player of his level. That works against the Steelers, his age, 30 years old. That works against the Steelers. But the contract is affordable, is I would consider it an asset. And so I think there are two pieces of that. And a lot of it, again, is going to depend on demand and how much demand the Steelers get, how many teams are out there bidding on them. All right. I appreciate all you guys coming out. As always, download and subscribe. You just hit that button on iTunes. We're always looking for your feedback. We want to make this your podcast. The next couple of weeks are going to be a little touch and go. I know next week I'm going to be in Mobile, Alabama. I'm not sure what the plan is for next week. I will keep you guys updated on that. Then we're at the Super Bowl, of course. And I will keep you updated on how we're going to handle Super Bowl week. Lots of stuff in the works for the next couple of weeks, so stay tuned on that. You can get to me on my Twitter page, at Albert Breer. You can get to me on my Facebook page, at Albert R. Breer. You can get to me on my Instagram, at Albert_Breer. And always remember to listen to all the MMQB NFL podcasts. This podcast, Gary and Andy's podcast, the gambling podcast, you can get them all in one place now, all in one feed, the MMQB NFL podcast. Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, Google Play, Apple Podcasts, wherever you guys get your shows, you can find us there. It won't be the same time next week. We're going to see. Stay tuned on when our next show will be and whenever that next show is. I'll see you guys then.